Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Todd Davies, author of the new novel Report to Megalopolis, or The Postmodern Prometheus. Published by Exterminating Angel Press, Report to Megalopolis is the fourth volume in Todd's History of Arcadia series. Todd's work includes Snotty Saves the Day, Lily, the Silent, and the Lizard Princess, the first three books in the History of Arcadia series, as well as the cooking memoirs Jam Today, A Diary of Cooking with What You've Got, and Jam Today 2, The Revolution Will Not Be Catered. Todd's also the editorial director and publisher at Exterminating Angel Press, and has worked as a screenwriter, film and television producer, social activist, radio show host, actor, and amateur cook. Author-editor Ed Battistella calls Report to Megalopolis an elusive and fast-paced tale, blending the lyricism of fairy tales with knife-in-the-rib social criticism, a dash of humor, and plenty of gruesome twists. Todd Davies, welcome to KBOO.
Ooh, thanks, Ken. I love to come here.
And you've been here, we were just talking, since 2009.
Yeah, I'm between the covers every year, every book, for sure.
Well, I'm proud to be the interviewer this time. Shout out first to Lynn Moluk, who can't be here today. I'm following in her large footsteps.
Hey, Lynn. Love you.
Now, Todd, when most of us hear the words fairy tale, we think of children's stories, maybe even of escapist stories meant to transport us to another world, to take us out of our reality. But you have a different view. You've said fairy tales talk about who we really are. What do you see as the role of fairy tales in our culture?
It's really funny that you should say that fairy tales are stories that take us out of our everyday reality, because that's what I think of most literary fiction. I think most literary fiction actually is portraying a world that's very narrowly focused and has a narrow paradigm and doesn't get outside of that. Some of it's wonderful. I mean, most of it is wonderful, but fairy tales are actually, and fantasy is actually, a way to blast out of those walls that we're enclosed in culturally and think about other ways of being. And original fairy tales, the kind that we now think of as quote-unquote only children's stories, which actually makes me laugh every time I hear it, they actually, if you read fairy tales seriously, they actually talk all the time about what being human really means and what the possibilities of being human are. C.S. Lewis, who you may have read.
Maybe when you were a child. The Witch and the Wardrobe.
He once said, "Someday you will be old enough to read fairy tales."
I haven't heard that quote. That's great.
It's one of my favorites.
Which brings me to my next question, actually. The child psychologist Bruno Bettelheim wrote a famous book, The Uses of Enchantment. He argued the importance of fairy tales to children, which you just mentioned is how they're often portrayed. But you've said fairy tales are really true and they're important. Fairy tales are not just little children's stories or things to be exploited by Walt Disney. What do you see as their importance to adults?
Just what I said, which is that they are about envisioning different ways of being. They are also about your psychological truth, about who you are emotionally. We fall into this thing of thinking that the truths about our world are what we call objective truths. Objective, though, is a very loaded word. The things that are outside of us, it's a story that we've all collectively created. I think we all agree that the story we've collectively created needs to move on right now. We need to move on.
It's not working.
It's not working. I mean, it worked for 2,500 years. That was great, man. I'm really in favor. I was in favor of all the periods where it worked, but it's not working now. And we need to get outside of that. And the place to get outside of that is in what Walida Emerisha has called visionary fiction. Which I think is a really good definition to call the kind of work that I do and the kind of work that many writers today are doing. Visionary fiction is fiction that's envisioning other worlds, other ways of being. It's interesting because the most exciting things that I've been reading recently are like economics texts, which are envisioning a different way of looking at economics. Kate Raworth's Donut Economics, for example.
And the Thomas Piketty book on capitalism.
Thomas Piketty, he's done a fantastic job of envisioning what's actually happening. But, you know, who you want to look at is Jason W. Moore, Capitalism in the Web of Life, and his work with Raj Patel. Incredible work, right? I've finally made connections with these guys, which is fantastic for me, because what I think is that we should be telling stories which are linked to what they're also doing, where they're pushing the theory forward. So it always shows up in stories earlier than it does in theory. And we are at an end game in many aspects of the culture right now. I think everyone can agree on that. Fairy tales, if you read fairy tales and you read children's books, what they're doing is they're re-envisioning, they are underlining what really is important to us as human beings, what's really important.
And you would classify fairy tales and fantasy as this visionary fiction?
It depends. It depends, because it's not true of all fantasy or science fiction or fairy tales. But visionary fiction would be anything that goes outside of what our regular world is and says, here's another way we can be human.
How about some of your influences besides C.S. Lewis and the economic texts? I know we talked about Ursula Le Guin. Tolkien, of course, Lord of the Rings. I read you also mentioned Octavia Butler, particularly her Kindred.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that is a wonderful example of visionary fiction. I mean, that book goes, I mean, I can hardly talk about it without getting quite emotional. I mean, that book really grabs you by the throat and knocks you against the wall and says, think about this. Fantastic book, and far more effective in opening up vistas than a history book would be, you know.
And Ursula Le Guin, you would classify too as
visionary fiction.
And you mentioned the Earthsea.
The Earthsea trilogy, or the series.
Or the tales.
All of her books. The Word for the World is Forest is another wonderful example of that. The Left Hand of Darkness, where she's actually envisioning a world where people change sex over the year and change their relationships. I mean, that's a mind bender too. I mean, she's amazing. In not fiction, Lewis Mumford, all of his writing is about...
And he was considered a sociologist mostly?
Or? I guess, yeah. I mean, he really was sui generis. Mm-hmm. He was really writing about what being human means in his History of the City. And what does building a city is about. His theory was that it was a biological aspect of being human, and it showed things about humanity and about where we were going. Fascinating.
I also wanted to mention, when I was researching the interview, I came across something you said about Marcel Proust's work. He's not often thought of as a fairy tale writer or fantasist. This is In Search of Lost Time, sometimes called Remembrance of Things Past. It used to be called that. And you called that multi-volume novel, you called it one long fairy tale. What do you mean by that? I never thought of it that way.
It's funny because I've never read that anybody thinks of it that way, but it's so clearly that. It's fairy tales are about transformation. Characters transform constantly from animals to humans, from poor people to princesses, it's constant transformation and constant change, which of course is the way the world is, really. All of Remembrance of Things Past or In Search of Lost Time is transformations of the characters from start to finish. They start in one position, they end in a totally different one. You know, the Duchesse de Guermont is like a princess. She's a fairy princess at the beginning, and at the end, she's like a peasant girl. It's all about, it is a fairy tale. It's a long fairy tale. So anybody who wants to write their thesis about this, you just get in touch with me.
Now, Todd, let's go from Proust to your History of Arcadia series. I don't think that's that big a transition, actually, after your explanation there. As mentioned in the intro, the new book, Report to Megalopolis, is the fourth volume in the series. Can you give us a little background on the world you created, Arcadia and Megalopolis?
Well, the original world of Arcadia was created in the first book, Snotty Saves the Day, and I know that's a horrible title, and I know the name Snotty is a horrible name, but that's the reason.
It makes it seem a little bit more of a children's book
and
than it is.
It's meant to be a children's book, but it's footnoted, as you've noticed, right, by a physicist in Arcadia who has discovered that there is potentially Arcadia's actual history and there's actual scientific meaning in this fairy tale. So you can read it either way. You can read just the children's book without the footnotes, or you can read it with the footnotes and find out what it has to do with Arcadia.
And that's Devendra Vale, who's also in the current book.
That's right. Devendra Vale, who I shouldn't say what happens to her at the end of Snotty.
Please don't, yes.
But in any case, she reappears in this book, which is told from the point of view of my villain, Aspirin Grayling, who is a scientist who was raised in Arcadia but then was educated in Megalopolis and thinks Arcadia is just a weak-willed, ridiculous little country that should just be taken over by Megalopolis. And he has created a godman to help him do this. And Devendra is his opponent.
Somewhat of his muse, in a way.
and I think that's really the point, which is that he...
His Jiminy Cricket.
It's Jiminy Cricket. That's great.
I shouldn't get a Disney reference. That's all right.
The transformations of all kinds are fascinating to me.
Now, I read that we have it right here. Snotty Saves the Day, and you were actually at KABU to interview with Lynn on the book. That was back in 2011. At the time, you said it was the first in a planned trilogy, and yet now we have the fourth volume, and I read that there might even be a fifth. I'll ask about that later. I'm guessing you felt there was a whole lot more to explore in this world you created and with these characters like Devendra.
Well, it's not me that did it. I mean, you just can't, writers know this. All of you guys out there know this. You know, they just start talking. They just start talking to you. And I thought three books, that was it. And then all of a sudden they're like, Aspern's like, no.
I've got my own book.
You want to hear from me, don't you? And that's what's happening with the fifth book as well. In this book, the two young women who I had not planned to have a big role in this book, had a bigger and bigger role. Isabella Scholar, who is the greatest who will become the greatest scientist Arcadia has ever produced, and her friend Shanti Vale, who is the heroine of all of the Arcadia books. They talked more and more about the fact that things have to change, but revolution tends to give energy to the side that you're fighting, and they have to find a way out of that. So they are writing the Evolutionary's Handbook. They are now evolutionaries. They've changed their name. This is what they're telling me, you know. And I have nothing to do with this except
and
to write it down.
And the fifth book will be mostly Shanti and Isabel the Scholar.
And Paavo, my mega villain in this book.
Right. Well, we'll get into that too, because I wanted to talk about Mary Shelley and Frankenstein.
Please
do. But first,
do.
A little bit more about Report to Megalopolis. The way it's structured, it's a series of reports, you know, it's clear from the title, to the leaders of Megalopolis on Arcadia. It's told by, you mentioned his name, Aspern Grayling. He's a somewhat sympathetic villain. There's a lot of three dimensions to him, three-dimensional person. Yeah. And you've likened the reports he sends to an NSA-style dossier of facts about Arcadia, of course, filtered through Aspern's perspective, for the use of the Megalopolitan Council of Four, which is considering how to conquer Arcadia. Why did you go with that structure? Was Aspern, you mentioned it earlier, he was speaking to you, he wanted his own book?
Well, it started being just the report. And it was, this is the ninth draft that you're reading. The original drafts were sort of a throwaway. It was a sort of, because I thought the trilogy was enough. It was supposed to be a semi-snarky look at him as he told about Arcadia through a series of reports. The more I wrote it, the more his suffering started to come through to me. And
that's where the sympathetic part comes in.
Indeed.
He didn't start out that way. He started out more as a villain.
He started out like a cardboard villain, mm-hmm. essentially. And by the ninth draft, I was really sorry for him.
Were you surprised then the evolution of Aspern?
Yeah. I mean, but I was very pleased, too. Huh. I was pleased because actually I feel that about just about every person I meet, that there is a huge story there that I'm not seeing, which is so interesting.
Now, you'd figure that a warlike technological society like Megalopolis would have no trouble conquering a bucolic, very peaceful place like Arcadia, but it's not so easy in the book. You write about Arcadia fighting the battle with softness, kindness, and commonality, and you say these are not weaknesses, these are strengths. We talked about politics before we got on the air a little, but it reminds me of what the Democrats were saying about the Republicans: when they go low, we go high. Doesn't seem to be working out so well. I also just came across this quote from the writer Robertson Davies, and that could be Davies or Davis. You're not related, though.
No, but I love
just made
him.
That connection.
I love the idea that I'm next to him in the library.
Oh, that's right. So he said kind of the opposite there. Life has made me aware of how far mean minds rely on the generosity of others. And you made some remark in the book, too, about how liberalism often works for the opponent, in this case, say the Republicans. Liberalism works for them because as Democrats, we're just too nice.
And in fact, that was one of the reasons why I started the trilogy, was because I was trying to figure out how do you push out ideas? How do you push out feelings of commonality, kindness, generosity, in a world that is stronger, that actually has like real weapons that can come back and obliterate you? And in the second book, Lily the Silent, Arcadia tries to fight back with Megalopolis's own weapons, and that does not work. But what you'll see in Report to Megalopolis is what I think we get wrong in the fight against evil now is that we use its weapons back and we accept its vision of what the battlefield is like. In Snotty, you may have read that the reason why Snotty ends up conquering Luke at the end is because Snotty walks away from the actual paradigm that he's supposed to be fighting in, and then he becomes a different person at that point.
And that's what the Arcadians actually use in this book, Report to Megalopolis.
But it's a much stronger force now, and they have to figure out a different way. So it's at the end, they have been partially conquered, but they are regrouping, and that's the next book, what's going to happen in the next book. And you also can see that. You can also see the chink in Pavo's armor at the end, because while he is not human, he yearns to be human, and he has actually fallen in love. So this is going to be an issue in the next book.
If you are joining us late, you're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, live in studio, we had Todd Davies, author of the new novel Report to Megalopolis, or the Postmodern Prometheus, published by Exterminating Angel Press. Todd, this year marks the bicentennial of Mary Shelley's book Frankenstein, was published in 1818. The full title of that book is Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. The full title of your new book is Report to Megalopolis or the Postmodern Prometheus, as I just said. To fully explain that, we probably should first go into the plot of the book. And you mentioned Pavo Vale, and he is created by Aspern Grayling. Unlike Dr. Frankenstein, who uses dead body parts and electricity, Aspern uses it, DNA editing and genetics. What was the influence of Mary Shelley's work on your book?
Well, I hadn't realized, until I got about halfway through the drafts, I hadn't realized essentially what I was doing was drawing on Frankenstein over and over and over again.
Oh, really? Unconsciously
or
subconsciously?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, Frankenstein had a big influence on me, as it's had on so many people.
Yes.
And the reason for that is it is a continually alive story for our time, and we're in the end game of what she was talking about at the beginning in 1816.
You can't control your creation, and it comes back to...
And not just that. It's the creation of Frankenstein is made, first of all, of the monster, is made because Dr. Frankenstein is terrified of death. It's because his mother has just died. And he yearns to create life without his feminine side. And the entire book is about the fact that he rejects his creation. He rejects family. He rejects community. He rejects anything except for his individual genius. And as a result, his world blows up. Does that sound like anything to anybody?
Yes, but his world hasn't blown up soon enough.
Well, and here we are.
Right.
In 2018, we're rejecting community, rejecting fellowship, only valorizing individual genius and the creations of individual patriarchal genius, like the atom bomb, for example, mm-hmm. are bringing us to the brink. And essentially that, Aspern's driving for that brink as well. And he does destroy everything that he loves because he thinks he should. He should do it in aid of his work. His work is more important than love.
I wanted to just bring up the myth of Prometheus. I had to look that up. There's actually two stories there. One of them is the better known one, and that's where he presented fire to humans, and that was against the edicts of the gods. So he was punished for eternity by having an eagle chew and eat his liver every day. It grew back at night and then back the next day.
Bummer.
Chewing on the liver. Yeah, awful. But what I didn't know, he also was credited with the creation of man out of mud, and then Athena breathed life into it. How do you see these myths relating to both Frankenstein and Report to Megalopolis, Prometheus himself?
Well, I think that it really, those myths are about the beginning of consciousness, because if you look at the art of if you look at Greek art, you can see a beginning of objectified consciousness, that, you know, you can see the art, you can see behind the person, and the pupils on the sculptures are wide open, like they're terrified of what they're seeing, and obviously the drama was incredible. And consciousness brought, it's kind of like a Garden of Eden myth. Consciousness brought with it a lot of pain and a lot of challenges. Yes. When Mary Shelley said the modern Prometheus, she was, whether she, how conscious she was of it, because we're all only intermittently conscious of why we're writing what we're writing. She was writing about how that myth had moved on and what it was doing then in 1818. Did you know the word scientist did not come into usage until about 20 years after she wrote that book?
No, but she was not responsible for the term coming to usage.
She was not, but she was writing about a period where that was where science was splitting off from the humanities. That she, Frankenstein in the book is a natural philosopher. He's not a scientist. Science then split off from philosophy, and philosophy is about why we are here. Science is, we don't care about why we're here. We want to know what this is. What right. is it, right? That split is what she's writing about. He's creating a monster, but he doesn't really have any reason to do it except that he can do it, right? So, and now we're in a postmodern period, same kind of thing, where that has kind of spun out. We've had an incredible run since for about 200 years of looking at things, quote unquote, objectively and quote unquote, rationally. And now that has to be expanded. That idea has to be expanded. And people, every writer out there should be dealing with these issues because we need all hands on deck, all hands on deck.
Now, we talked about the creation of the monster. So there's really no reason that Dr. Frankenstein is creating his monster. But there is a reason why Aspern Grayling is creating Pavel Vale. And that's his plan to invade and conquer Arcadia.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of secondary, really. It's that he wants to be the best. He wants to be the best scientist. He wants the head of Megalopolis to think he's the A student. I mean, he's still a little boy in a lot of ways.
Well, a lot of scientists are, I think.
All of us are
I worked in the computer industry for a long time, and a lot of the developers, the programmers, kind of felt that like little boys, but they were creating our world. Actually, this is our world today, what I was witnessing.
Well, the truth is we are all still that little kid that we were. Every single one of us is still like that, and we need to accept that, and we need to reveal that more, which is another reason why people are so contemptuous of children's stories. It's because they're terrified of revealing that they are still that child.
Now, Pavel Vale, who's Aspern's creation in the book, he's actually tested by the scientists in Arcadia. He's found to have no soul, yep. No altruism, no empathy, no spiritual understanding, no care for nature. So you'd figure a person like that, a creation like that, would be incapable of love, warmth, and humanity. But that's not necessarily the case here. He's meant to be.
Uh-huh. He's meant, and he was engineered to be that way. And the character that he desires in the book, he just desires. That's the implication. It's not love, it's desire. But then something weird starts happening.
Yeah, I don't know how much we should go into that, but mm-hmm. I was kind of surprised there. I was wondering what was happening with Pavel Vale. But same thing with Aspern Grayling. It just began as just kind of a one-dimensional villain and became a little bit more, a lot more.
And, you know, and Frankenstein's monster is the same. Frankenstein's monster is created to be a monster, essentially, and he wants love. That's all he wants.
Yeah, I think you mentioned, I can't find it right here. Let's see. Something about we feel sympathy for, he's the sympathetic one. You said hardly anyone notices Shelley's monster as the sympathetic one, denied love, denied warmth, denied common humanity, then he turns against all love, warmth, and humanity. That's something we don't normally get out of that book.
You don't because of the movies, because of all the popularization of it. But that is really the middle of the book. That's the big part of the book where the monster pleads with Frankenstein to give him some kind of community.
In addition to the myths and the fairy tales, I found, and you must have put it in there, there's a religious connection here in a report to Megalopolis. Unlike Frankenstein's monster, who was created on an operating table in a laboratory, Pavel Vale was created by impregnating a real woman, that's Merope Vale, with Aspern's DNA concoction, whatever he came up genetically with. So it's very much like the story of a real woman, Mary, giving birth through immaculate conception. All right, I got that out of it.
Wow, Ken, you know what? I never noticed I did that.
Really?
Oh, my gosh. I have to think about this.
That's what I was going to ask you about.
But you're completely right. I'm like sitting here going, how could I have missed that? But you see, that's what I mean. You don't notice what you're doing. You don't notice what symbols come up when you do
this. Yeah, so my question was,
of course, her name's Merope.
Merope, yeah. I saw the
Mary
there. Yeah. So that must have been subconscious, but I was going to ask you about the connection between...
I was raised Catholic. Yeah.
Well, there you have it. Yeah. Between fairy tales, myth, and religion.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely.
Actually, they're all fairy tales in a way, unless you add faith and belief, and then they become your reality.
Well, and that's the thing is that if you say it's a fairy tale, people get upset because they think you're dissing it. And of course, and that happened to me once. I was at dinner at an Oxford High table, and somebody said something about the virgin birth, and I said, that was a wonderful fairy tale. And this physicist, a Nobel Prize winning physicist, said to me, I've never heard it called a fairy tale. And I said, no, you don't understand. That's a compliment for me.
Yes, it is, the way you've talked about fairy tales. But a lot of people use that as a put down.
Yeah. And isn't that funny that it was a Nobel Prize winning physicist who got really mad at me for saying it was a fairy tale? I thought that was really funny. He did walk me home afterward.
You hit a nerve.
I guess I did. Yeah.
Now, I've heard rumors, in addition to the fifth volume, which we've talked about, Isabel the Scholar and Shanti Vale, I've heard rumors that you might be combining the fantasy worlds of Arcadia Megalopolis with your cookbook writing. I wondered if there was any truth to that, and if there is, I have a suggested title.
Oh, suggest the title.
Once Upon a Time. what a lousy pun.
I don't think we're going to put you on the consultancy list.
No. I just lost a job. Is that true? Is that in the works,
though? Well, the original idea was that this was going to be a really silly, just one-off that was going to describe Arcadia, and then I would do a cookbook afterward. Probably what will end up happening is the cookbook will end up being like Report to Megalopolis, and I'll write 20 versions of it, and then it will be a really
story. The characters will start speaking to you.
Yeah.
Now, one more question, because we have about a minute or so to go.
Don't forget you have to mention what I'm doing tonight.
Why don't we just go right to that in our minute? Tonight you'll be at Powell's Books on Hawthorne at 7:30, and you'll be talking, of course, about Report to Megalopolis and signing books, and you'll also be talking about Mary Shelley and Frankenstein. What's the plan then? What can listeners expect if they come tonight?
They can expect that I'm going to want them to talk and ask me questions and tell me what they think about visionary fiction, about Mary Shelley, about Frankenstein, about this. And the section that you mentioned where the Arcadian scientists test Pavo and find out he has no soul is the part I'm going to read.
Ah. So it's well worth it to show up tonight at Powell's on Hawthorne.
It's always fun.
Yeah. And Todd's wonderful to speak with, as you can
Ken. Oh, well, you can have that job after all.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
No more foolish puns, I promise. Well, Todd Davies, thanks very much for joining us today at KABU.
Thank you so much for having me, as always.
We've been talking with Todd Davies, author of the new novel Report to Megalopolis, or The Postmodern Prometheus, published by Exterminating Angel Press. As mentioned, Todd will be reading at Powell's on Hawthorne tonight and signing books and asking you in the audience to help contribute to the talk tonight at 7:30. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Todd for visiting us at KABU and to all of you for listening.